Cape Canaveral, where he has a landing zone, one they call it. Used to be Launch Complex 13 that he took over. But Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin and the New Glenn rocket will also land on a barge. Building his own barge, a little bit bigger than what Elon Musk has, but he will not be sending his rockets. They will not be capable of going back to land on land, but nevertheless reusable. Let me drop it. Elon Musk has already sent up reused rockets, reused boosters. He's up to half a dozen of them now. And Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, but right from the start, the New Glenn rocket will be reusable like 100 different times. And that's the same goal for SpaceX. The new version of the Falcon 9 rocket that he used as a useful now, they'll be using for the 10 weeks of time. But nevertheless, that brings the course of space to travel way down. The average cost for a Falcon 9 rocket to take off is around $60 million, $52 million. That has, to give you an idea, the rocket I saw it take off from California on Friday, the rocket is built by United Launch Alliance, the Delta IV. That thing was about, I believe it's $120 million to get off the ground, so roughly twice the price. So big competition there. And there's a big movement to have reusable vehicles. Another way around this reusability thing is to actually take a rocket, attach it to an airplane carrier, and bring it up to 50,000 feet and drop it. And let, after dropping it, having it ignite and go into space. This guy, Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft. He's presently building the Stratolaunch. Stratolaunch is, as far as wingspan goes, the biggest plane ever built. 360 some odd feet from wingtip to wingtip. And this plane is so big that, you know, he wants to carry so much weight on it, he wants to actually carry a rocket, the equivalent of a second stage rocket, and a payload on this thing up to 50,000 feet, and then just drop it and have it take off. And the plane is called the Stratolauncher, and it's completely built. And just a couple of weeks ago, he took it out of the hangar and fired up the six engines. He's got six Pratt & Whitney 747 jet engines attached to this thing. Three engines on one side, three engines on the other, and two long fuselages. And then down the middle, he'll be able to carry the rocket. Right now, he's got a contract with Orbital Science, which presently launches the Pegasus rocket, which is similar to, which has been launched many times by Orbital Science. In that fashion, it's being dropped from the plane. This guy, Paul Allen, is building this plane specifically for this purpose, and he plans on being able to drop different kinds of payloads, and maybe eventually manned payloads. Might even put a Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser has the capability of having a crew. He might be able to do that. So a lot going on in space. Plenty of different topics to cover. I won't continue. But if anybody has any questions or comments, Please speak now. This is WS2N for the TechNet, space portion of that TechNet. Was that Wesley? Go ahead.
Gosh, I didn't think I sound that much like Wesley. It is AC2GS. And I just wanted to know, Paul, if you were aware that Cosmos has been renewed for a second season.
No, I wasn't. So is Neil deGrasse Tyson going to do that as well?
If that's the game plan, all the people that were involved in the first season will be involved in the second. Seth MacFarlane, I guess, is producing. Carl Sagan's widow will be involved. It's not going to be until 2019 that it's going to show up, but I thought that would be exciting to a lot of people who enjoyed the first season. I particularly enjoyed the original Cosmos. It's probably not fair to compare the two, but what the hell? Life isn't fair.
I have the original books, and of course the series that Carl Sagan did was great, and Anne Duran, that was the lady he had married, and then she was involved with the Fiennes as well, and I believe she had the rights to Cosmos and was able to make a deal. Make the arrangements for that last Cosmos show that Tyson did. So the second one, you know, with all the discoveries that keep coming up, you know, they come up with these things at a faster rate. You know, like the next 10 years will be, you know, double the amount of knowledge that we got, you know, in the last 100 years. And it goes on like that, so I can see every couple of years having a new show, with, you know, with new material. I just watched one recently on the Nova show, a two-hour special, and I believe it was called Black Hole Armageddon, and the narrator was Jenna, J-A-N-N, Jenna Levin, I think her name was. Terrific job they did on black holes. I mean, really good. You know, everybody thinks, well, there's a black hole here, black hole there. They went into supermassive black holes, how they know the size of it, how they determine, you know, the power of these things, how they determine the mass. And it was really a good show. I don't know if you caught that on Nova. Boy, AC2 GSWS2N.
I've fallen behind my Nova watching. We live in a great time as far as these documentaries are concerned. They seem to have a good budget, so they don't scrimp on the effects, and they produce very, very professional stuff. And so that's why I was always kind of dubious about Cosmos, as much as I love the original. The same thing is kind of done all over the place. Cable stations do these expensive, highly produced documentaries, and of course PBS does them. And even there are some guys out there on YouTube that produce near professional levels of documentaries these days. So I'm willing to bet you almost anything that the next season of Cosmos has at least one episode where they go into gravity waves, because gravity waves for me was the big thing in 2017 as far as scientific discovery that was announced. They might have found other things but not announced them yet, but gravity waves to me wins the 2017 award.
Yeah, this show by Jenna Levin, that when she was talking, she started off talking about the gravity waves and went through this whole show, you know, how they detected the black holes and all, and 2 hours of you know, the science behind it, the history behind it, and sure enough, the last half hour or so was dedicated to the LIGO project itself. And covered us pretty in depth. They had Kip Thorne on. He's one of the big time astrophysicists. You know, a lot of people gave their opinions and their stories. He talked about his bet that he had with Hawkins about whether or not this one black hole that, well, they didn't know it was a black hole at the time. They were trying to figure out whether it was or not. And he had a bet with Hawkins that, you know, he was saying that it was a black hole, and Hawkins said no, and 20 or 30 years went by, and finally Kip Thorne won. So, good show. I'm sure they'll probably repeat it. It's brand new. It came out, I guess, a few weeks ago. Back to you, Rob.
Yeah, I got all these shows on my hard drive. It's just a matter of finding the actual time to watch them. You know, it's a lot of things that you can do. You got YouTube, you got all kinds of things on the internet. You have television, you got video documentaries, and then you got these interesting new inventions that they call books. So it's just a matter. I'm working feverishly on a time machine to create the 27 and a half hour day. Once I do that, I'm going to have a lot more free time.
Let me answer the question. That's the voice I heard before. Wesley, go ahead.
I remember in 2012 I spoke to Dick on TechNet, and there was John with us at that time, and there was a question about colonization of the moon. And then I, just for fun, I took the statistic addition equation, and I was trying to find out how probable it is for men to be again in the moon. Let me jump. I took the two events, A and B, and that was the events in Russia and in America at that time. And I was trying to have a mutually exclusive probability of those events. So say event A and B occur, the sum of the probability of each event, or the probability of A and B will occur, there will be the sum of probability of each event. And then I came minus the probability of overlap. So I came then to sort of assumption that 2019 to 2021, men will return to a moon again. Let me drop. And then a question to you would be actually a little bit funny. In 1638, John Wilkins, that was a bishop, he actually was the first one who wrote this course concerning the new world of another planet, and he predicted human colony on the moon. There was Sosnowski, that was Clark, and plenty of others. Now, what are we, where we are right now in terms of instead of building a space station, actually having one of the polar regions on the moon, permanent station of the human species. And to
Asia. Well, I know we're getting there. I mean, the ultimate plan was to go to Mars for the last 8 years. This administration has kind of changed it. They want to revisit the moon, going back to a George Bush type of idea. George Bush had the Constellation program, where we're going to have these Ares 4 rockets, Ares 1 rockets. We're going to launch, they're going to dock in Earth orbit, take off, go to the moon, and then they had their lander all planned. But these plans were all scrubbed. It was all part of the Constellation program. The only thing that's really stayed was the Orion spacecraft itself, which is reusable, that was going to sit on the top of the rocket, which is under development, and I expect that in a couple of years to be launched on the SLS. It's already been launched test the heat shield and all back in 2014. So, you know, we're coming along. We have this Orion spacecraft that originally was being built to go to the moon, and okay, now we're going to go to Mars during the Obama administration. Now we're going back to the moon and Mars at the same time. They're kind of going to do both at one time. Are we going to get there? One second. Yes, I believe we will. And are we going to stay there? And I believe, again, we will. But a lot of things have to happen. And if we don't, we're going to be in big trouble because China is planning on going to the moon, setting up some kind of a base. India, they're going to be behind China, I guess, but they have long-term visions of going to the moon, staying there. And I sure wouldn't want to be left behind. We've landed 12 people on the moon. I think about half of them are gone now. We lost, just recently, we lost Cernan. He passed away. He was the last man to walk on the moon. Then you have John Young, just a week or so ago. We just lost him. Apollo 16, he walked on the moon. And there's many others. Out of the 12, I think probably about half of them are already gone. So we need to go back. We need to stay. Let me drop.
And where are we going to stay?
Right now, they don't officially have a lander yet. The company I mentioned before, Blue Origin, is working on a lander vehicle that will land supplies on the moon. And I think probably, in the long run, we could probably develop it to have people, but I think that will probably have to be maybe a NASA-type program in the beginning. But in the long run, he might be able to do both, and that's Blue Origin. His landing vehicle is called the Blue Moon. Just like Amazon sends supplies all over the Earth, well, he wants to be able to supply moon villages if they're built. But now, to get there, we have to first get into moon orbit, or even a halo orbit around the moon, with a space station. They call it the Gateway. First, we'll send a propulsion unit up on an SLS rocket. And my guess is that will probably be about, let's see, I'm going to guess 4 years from now. At best, we'll send up a habitat unit, which will be able to be docked with it. And then another storage type unit. So you'll have basically a small space station capable of carrying four people. That's the plans now. They haven't really gotten to the point where they're developing hardware yet, but the plans are to develop the space gateway. Now you have people in permanent orbit. In the beginning, it will be 40-day missions, and then it will be abandoned and eventually send back another crew for another 40 days, and they will eventually, I would guess, get to the point where you could have a permanent habitat of people going around the moon, just like we have the ISS. We have six people, soon to be seven. They would like to see at least four people permanently on a space station at the moon. And then at that point, or as they're developing that system, they want to think about sending people down to land on the moon. There's no permanent base plan. I know they would like to put one near Shackleton Crater on the South Pole to start. They talk about living in lava tubes on the moon. They know where they are, and they'd be able to, like, live underground, protect themselves from radiation and all. I believe they would have to be able to get the okay for fission nuclear power to really do this right, not only for the moon, but for Mars. you know, the technology is advanced to the point where maybe they can do that. You know, the public really doesn't like the idea of launching some kind of a nuclear device in space. They get nervous every time you have an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, put on a spacecraft. You know, those things supply heat, creates electricity, using thermocouples. The thermocouples in turn charge batteries, and that's how you could have these long-term missions like Galileo and Cassini and Voyager. And, but, you know, it's a nuclear device. And even when Cassini went up, there was protests. Let's not launch this thing. It might come down and, you know, kill everybody. So once they overcome that problem, the perception of the danger of this thing, or maybe they could assemble it in space or assemble it in moon orbit, you know, put a couple of the pieces together and make them active up there, maybe the people would feel better about it. You're going to probably need nuclear power. Solar panel, yeah, that's good. Eventually you're going to need nuclear power, also for propulsion. You know, they have these ion engines now. They work good, but if you want more powerful engines, and if you want to be able to go to a deeper, darker place in space, eventually you're going to need fission power to power these things. The sun rays are good, solar panels and all. It works on, up to, the asteroid belt. Maybe if you're lucky to go over to Jupiter, but if you want to go beyond that, you're going to need ion rockets. They call them stuff, solar, electric propulsion. So we're a long way from doing it. China has plans, India has plans, but I hope we do it. I think we will probably colonize the moon first, to some degree, and then off to Mars. There's a book that came out that Roy talks about. It's called Modern. It's also the author that wrote the book, Martian version of the book. Eventually they made that book. The book is called Artemis, and it's about 100 years from now, and the moon is already developed. They have one town, one city, that's been developed on the moon, and the whole story about, you know, the town that has been created up called Artemis. It's a very good book, though. So, that'll give you an idea of what might be going on 100 years from now. Predicted a couple of thousand people living at that location. One on the moon. I guess by the time we get into it, they'll have to get a couple of hands up there. Any other questions or comments?
What's your geographic location for the possible base? And then, temperature stability. 1 meter, which would be 3 feet below the surface, steady temperature of minus 57 Celsius. Question, if we go deeper, would we have less severe one? But minus 53 is a typical a winter weather in some region of Russia and Turkey.
Yeah, they want to go to the South Pole first. That would be Shackleton Crater. That's the first location the United States would be interested in. Mostly in the sun, the way the moon is sitting, it gets sun, like, most of the time. So, that's important. Because you could lay out all these solar cells and all, but eventually, you know, you're going to need backups. You're going to need... I say you have to have nuclear power. You don't have enough RTG, plutonium-238 supply to create RTG type of power supplies. And, you know, they only put out about 100 watts or so, a little bit more than that. You're going to need nuclear power. And even if you go a lot deeper than 3 feet or so underground, they plan on going like 30, 40, 50 feet underground. There's these big lava tubes that they know that are on the moon, and you can put a whole city in these things. But, you know, you need to have, you know, you can't have solar panels. You can for, you know, for 40 days. The other 40 days on the moon is dark. It's not going to work. So you're going to need some other kind of power. And you need backups and all. You know what happens here with backup systems. Can't depend on either just nuclear or solar. You know, you have to have both, and preferably fuel cell, what the space shuttle used to use, and the Gemini Apollo program, they used to use fuel cells. You know, once you have all this water and everything on the moon or on Mars, have that as either primary or backup system. They're going to need plenty of energy to keep warm, grow things, create, you know, they know where the water is on Mars. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has found plenty of water on Mars. They know where it is on the moon, down in the craters. They can get it out. They can use that water eventually for themselves to drink, and eventually to separate it with electrolysis. And then you eventually have hydrogen and oxygen, you know. You'll actually have fuel to get off the planet or off the moon. Any other comments or questions? WS2N.
Is it crater that you mentioned in the South Pole?
Power generators.
Yeah, if you look up Shackleton crater, you'll see it on the South Pole of the moon. And something about power generators there, Roy?
Yeah, I think this unfortunately is going to wait for the most part until we to make fusion generators. It's sufficient, and if it blows up on the way there, you don't irradiate the entire population. So I think unfortunately we have a technological little problem that we have to solve before we do any significant. Because we need a lot of energy to get any of this done. Requires a lot more energy than we can get with solar batteries. Or minor radioactive decay. So I think we're kind of stuck.
Probably.
Yeah, if we have to wait for fusion, I mean, the Tokamak project, they've been trying to get off the ground for decades. They can't get a sustained fusion reaction longer than, I don't know, a couple of seconds, or maybe, I don't know if it's microseconds, or I think they got a couple of seconds out of it once or something. But if we have to wait for that, we're not going anywhere, Roy.
I'm not quite as sanguine as you are. You know, fusion generation has been 10 to 20 years in our future for at least 50 years. So I figure it'll be that same 10 to 20 years for the next 50 years. But no one ever called me an optimist.
Well, let me make a comment.
I concur. No, we can't wait for fusion. We're not going anywhere. We'll be talking about robotics, satellites, which I think is great. But the public doesn't just want to fund robotic satellites. You know, it's manned missions that really generate the money, the excitement. Although I would say we probably get a lot more science out of the robotic missions. You have to have both. Voyages, the reason they're on their way out there, and the Vikings, the first Vikings to land on Mars, that had to do with money momentum. You know, there was so much money in the space program, and you know, gross national product dedicated to sending people to the moon, manned missions, that after it was over and they decided to cancel all the satellites. Five missions. We got up to what, 17, and they canceled. You know, there were three other missions planned. You were supposed to get to 20, but they canceled it. but the money still was there, still going to somewhere, so it went off to a lot of deep space robotic missions, which we probably got the most science out of. Was it Wesley that said something? Was that you, Wesley? WSL.
Yeah, there are more than 30 different nuclear reactor-powered satellites still on the orbit of the Earth. As far as I know, U.S. launched only one, Russia did the rest, and there was reactors similar to the one in nuclear power plants. However, they don't necessarily, they never blow. So uranium-235 undergoes fission where its nucleus splits, giving off, but there are plenty of other nuclear power devices on satellites by itself in a separate form of power supply, where actually the waste, the nuclear waste, could be used, and not, that would never blow like a thorium. So I don't believe there is a problem in the safe nuclear reactor on the moon. Maybe I'm wrong, Dr. Roy.
To me, there's a good reason why these are all Russian satellites and devices, because Russia and the Soviet Union never asked anyone's opinion, certainly not their own citizens. You announced that America is going to launch radioactive material with an X percentage chance of it blowing up in the atmosphere, and everyone and their brother is going to come out and parade around. It's just, you know, a totalitarian state can get away with a lot more than a democratic one.
Point.
Yeah, I know the Russians say they did launch a fission reactor at one point. It didn't work too good, but they did do it. Just wanted to go over one other topic. I know I emailed you about it, but we talked about the gyros, the ring gyros last week. There's something called a spherical resonated gyro, and it's called guard G system. It's a thing gyro that's been, actually been around for a number of years now. Let me drop it. And they plan on putting this on the Webb telescope, which will be launched early 2019, a year from now. But it's an interesting gyro. It doesn't work under the same principle with the Sagnac principle with the ring gyro. It works like a wine glass. So I don't know if you've had a chance to look and research it a little bit. Ago, but haven't really brought it up since. But it works like a wine glass. If you bang a wine glass, it will create a resonance frequency. And if you turn that, you're going to get certain nulls. And depending on you know how you turn this thing, and it was actually being developed. The idea came out in the late 1800s. But eventually they started to develop it. Now it's on spacecraft. It's the hemispherical resonated gyro. Have you heard of this thing, Roy? AC2GSWS.
AC2GS. Yes, I've read a little bit about it. And personally, in my mind, it's easier to reconcile how a ring interferometer works due to special relativity than all of the very esoteric concepts that are folded in to this hemispheric gyroscope. It's actually built like a wine glass if you inverted the cup where you drink in the other direction towards the handle. And it's made of incredibly highly machined quartz crystals. And it's a piezoelectric effect, like the crystals in your radio. You apply an electrical charge, and there is a resonant frequency The Q factor for these things apparently are something like 2 or 3 million, which is a really high Q factor. And what happens apparently is it sets up standing waves, and by rotating it, the angular velocity that you rotate the device produces something called a precession, which is another current of the standing wave starts to travel in a strange position based upon the rotation angular velocity that you're rotating, and the quartz crystal and contacts can read how the standing wave precesses and figure out what its angular velocity is. So you have to understand, unfortunately, the Coriolis effect, standing wave effect, and precession effect. So it's a very, very complicated, very highly machined, and there's only, to my knowledge, two companies that can build these darn things, because they have to be built to incredibly high tolerances.
Okay, only two companies. I know Northrop Grumman handles it. I guess there's another one. But you've already answered the question. That was what I was looking for. I searched the internet high and low last couple of weeks. And I know highly machined, but I couldn't figure out making this thing fire. You know, I know they said electrical connections. And my question was going to be, you know, is it a piezoelectric effect? Because that's, you know, that's what's involved with that. You have a quartz, one connection on one side, one on the other, and this thing, you can get a frequency out of it, and say you get your crystals. So apparently it's not being done the same way. And they say that the same connections that are connected to it are also reading the information out of it. Now, years ago, when I first heard about this, you know, and you're right, they said it's like a wine glass, and then they created a mushroom type of system where you take the stem and you put the stem on the inside. Originally, they were designing it like a white wine glass, is what I read. But they said that you could actually test this thing. So if you have a phone record at home or any kind of turntable, naturally photograph or LP record player, you could take this wine glass and put it on it. It doesn't have to be in the center. Let me drop it. And you could tap the side of it, and you could hear it, you know, the ringing of this wine glass. You turn on your record player, you can turn it by hand if you have one that'll move by hand, and rotate this thing. And as it's going around, you could hear the nulls. It's almost like going off and on. You hear the constant ringing, but, you know, you could actually hear it going on and off. And it's got like about 4 nulls. But you could hear this ding, 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 ding type noise, you know, as you're turning it. And they said, I don't know, I haven't done this, but if you actually sat on a turntable, and doesn't matter where you sit on the turntable, but if you sat on the turntable and you did the same thing and rang the wine glass, let me drop it. And as it's vibrating, somebody else will take the turntable, but you want, you're holding the wine glass, and as you're sitting around, you'll get the effect. You'll still hear the difference, even so you're going around with that wine glass. Fascinating. And they take these readings, and they said it's, you know, there's been only like 400 or 500 of these things manufactured so far. But when they do it, it's you put it on a rocket ship with all the vibration and everything, nothing affects this thing. Even a power outage, if you lose a couple of seconds, couple of seconds come back, and if the thing was in the process of turning, it'll pick up where it left off. Apparently, you know a lot about it. I was missing the piezoelectric effect there, Roy, so thanks for that. HT2GSWS2N.
Quite welcome. It's a fascinating device. It's sort of amazing to me that a device that was kind of explained so long ago, I doubt that you could have actually machined anything that would work until maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, because, you know, the design has been around for much longer than our ability to machine it.
Yeah, its first mission was the NEAR spacecraft. That was the one that went out to one of the asteroids, Malvahide, and then it went out to another one called Eros. And NEAR actually went into orbit around Eros. And this thing was so precise that, with the, you know, with this gyro on board, they had no problem. Toward the end of the mission, after a year or so, whatever it was, of orbiting Eros, they brought it down, and it didn't have any landing gears on the spacecraft. They never planned on landing this. At the end, they said, what are we going to do with this? Let's see if we can soft land it on this asteroid. So they succeeded. It was the first time that was ever done. And now did it work out where it landed. It didn't crash or fall over. It came down so softly, they were able to do it based on this gyro and the thrusters that they had, where it just landed on the asteroid, and then it kept transmitting until one day they said, you know, let's just shut it off, you know, there's no more science coming out of this, so they turned off the transmitter. So that was pretty amazing. Eventually, there was a follow-up mission to Saturn called Cassini, which descended. It was launched, 1997. Got into orbit around Cassini in 2004, and spent until a couple months ago in September, they finally decided to deorbit Cassini along with its atmospherical resonator gyro into the atmosphere, and they burnt it up to destroy that spacecraft. And so that was on board Cassini. It was also on board Messenger. Messenger was the spacecraft that went out to Mercury and orbited Mercury for quite a while. And they claim this is like, you know, the best gyro ever. And it's very small. It's only, you know, like, you know, the size of a half a dollar or something. Not a gram, they said. So it's very small, and it works perfectly in a vacuum. If there was an atmosphere around, it doesn't work that good. But, you know, since space is a vacuum, it's perfect location for it. Now, the pros and cons. Apparently, it must be very expensive. That's the other thing. I'm trying to find out what this thing must cost if there's only, you know, a couple of them out there. And apparently, that's why they use the ring gyros on boosters like SpaceX and, you know, with the Falcon 9 and your the everyday boosters. I think they run the ring gyros because they're, you know, relatively cheap. But if you're going to go on a long duration, you know, a couple of $1 billion spacecraft, they like to use these ring gyros. So they've been around for in space travel for at least almost a little over 20 years now. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GSO, Brave New World. Fascinating. What I particularly like about these gyros is they didn't start life as an excuse for proving ether and all kinds of bad science that never worked out. It started life as a design for a very, very a clever gyroscope and succeeded. And yes, you can't use it in air for very long because the air will dampen the resonant frequency. So it's more efficient in a vacuum than it would be in any kind of an atmosphere. And it doesn't scale up to any good use. It just increases the cost of manufacture. So the idea is you keep it as small as you can for it to be structurally rigid enough to survive acceleration, deceleration, what have you. So it's a fascinating design, but it requires such great tolerances that I think it's a design for the past unless something changes. It's just so much easier to generate ring interferometers. They don't require the tolerance that a hemispheric gyroscope requires.
Yeah, when I was first reading about this, I saw that it was very hard to manufacture. It sounded like this frail little thing. So I thought, well, this isn't going to be any good. And then as I was reading through this one PDF file, and it must have been, I don't know, 30 pages on and on, they were claiming it had 100% success. And I'm trying to think how many hours of testing or actual use. Some huge number, 12 million hours or something of operation, you know, forever. And all the testing and all the operational gyros that they've used, they said have succeeded 100%, not like 99.9. So I'm amazed at this. What seemed to me like a frail thing that they're building turned out to be such a reliable, dependable gadget. Back to you, Roy, if anybody has any questions, we're open to it.
And take care.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Coming back to thermoelectric generators, which are a nuclear one, and the words about public opinion. Well, in 2011, the Curiosity Mars rover had 4.8 kilograms of plutonium dioxide, and a pretty good move. So, actually, this thing cannot ever blow. It used the temperature to convert to the thermal energy to be converted to electrical energy. So, yes, America built only one satellite. The nuclear power plenty other devices they sent out to complete the missions. Let me drop. So, my question is, what is the situation with the Curiosity Mars rover? The power supply must be working, but I know there was some problem with it. And the second question is, we have a GPS satellite, and those are, if I'm correct, powered by the solar panels. There is a certain lifespan of the solar panels, and what are we doing to keep our GPS going on? And to exchange.
Yeah, well, it's not only us with the GPS. The Russians have their version. Now, China, just in fact, last week they sent up their first. Well, I think they're going to have at least 18. They have their own GPS. European Space Agency has sent up half a dozen or more. I think they're up to about 10 by now of their constellation GPS. I don't like this. Yeah, to me, the Galileo is the spacecraft that went to Jupiter. That gets confusing. But they have their own. And Japan has their own. Japan has a lot of deep valleys, you know, they have rugged terrain. Some locations don't get pick up our GPS signals that good. So they're sending on, theirs on a different kind of orbit, highly inclined orbit. A higher apogee orbit, where the high points are always over Japan to pick up to transmit, receive a signal there. Kind of hard, so that's going to take care of it. But all of these are supposed to be eventually seamless with each other to improve the accuracy no matter where you go in the world. And then they run off of solar panels and there's always additional ones that they send that you know, they're not even functioning. They're actually backups in case something fails. So we're going to have hundreds of these things flying around collectively worldwide, all the different countries that are contributing to the constellations. So, and as far as the RPGs, about 100 watts or so for curiosity. They've been used on, you know, probably less than 10 different space years radio scope thermoelectric generator. Yeah, they used plutonium 238, things around that with graphite blankets, and then inside that they have all these thermocouples hooked into each creating millivolts, and but if you pop in series and enough of them in parallel, eventually voltage and amperage to wind up with 100 watts, so usually a little bit more than 100 watts. And since they've started using these, they had two on the original Pioneer spacecraft, which have on the way out of the solar system, along with the Voyager spacecraft, the officially out of the solar system. And then you have the two Viking missions that landed on Mars, carried their RTGs. You had the Ulysses spacecraft, which went into orbit around the sun. I'm dropping into a polar orbit around the sun. And to get there, it used Jupiter as a slingshot to change its trajectory to get out of the ecliptic and put it into a polar orbit. You know, that had an RPG, and now you have the Horizon, and you've got the first one on Mars, Curiosity, as well as the one that's being built, Mars 2020, also being built with an RTG. So that's 10 of them, and I'm sure a couple more have had them. But that's, you know, that's the most popular ones I can think of. There's not many. Each one, like you said, has about, you'll use the kilograms. I think it's roughly around 9 pounds per unit. Let me drop it. You know, some of them, like Voyager, had four on each one. Pioneer, three. So, you know, you add it up, and, you know, there isn't all that much, and we don't have that much left. So, you know, it's really an ash of the garbage that you get after creating nuclear bombs. You know, you wind up with this uranium-238 that they utilize for RTGs. This one I'm making anymore, nuclear bomb. You have the de-escalation of the nukes. We just don't have that much being made anymore. Well, not at all. Any other questions, comments?
Maybe we could ask North Korea if we can borrow some.
Yes, have a bunch now, yes. They're probably storing it somewhere. They'll be able to sell it, you know. Get something for their troubles, I guess, Roy.
There is
a call for gas. Don't really have that much more for the space program. We'll see. It's going to be an interesting year coming up. This May, we have a launch to Mars called InSight. InSight will be launched to Mars. It's not a rover. It's just land in one spot. probably roughly around the equator. And it's going to dig into the Martian surface, probably about 50 feet into the ground. I have to see how this works, but, you know, they're going to dig 15 feet down into the ground and put a thermometer down there and test the temperature. And they're going to study inside of Mars. There's a seismometer on there. They want to look for Mars quakes and all of that. But inside was supposed to be in 2016. But like a lot of these missions we get involved with other countries helping out, and then when they help out, they get, you know, that's their ticket to getting science back from whatever mission it might be. And we jump on board the European Space Agency project. So that's the way it works. And CNES, that's their space program. And they were developing this vacuum tank that was supposed to be put on InSight 2 years ago. And it needed to have a perfect vacuum to work. It's going to be part of this seismometer. And they kept winding up. And they couldn't fix it in time. They couldn't make a perfect vacuum out of the thing. And eventually it turned over. They dropped it, and Jeff Wilson Laboratory took over. And they wound up perfecting this. It is out of a titanium, what have you. And they wound up scheduled to relaunch the ignition, I believe in May. And that will take, what, 6 to 8 months to get to Mars. We'll have another lander on Mars taking off this year. So we'll cover all these different missions that come up during the year on the net. Any other questions or comments?
I wonder how we're managing our nuclear material for defense industry. We don't make plutonium any longer.
What, for the military? Well, they don't need it. We've got plenty of nuclear. I think we could wipe out the Earth a half a dozen times over or something. So they don't need to make any more. I guess that's good. You know, you make them, I guess, good for what they don't wear out.
The lifetime of the typical nuclear weapon had is 10 to 12 years. So, I have a problem with that, Dr. Roy.
How about that? I mean, the half-life on the stuff that they're making is 12 years. It was like a million years or something.
Yeah, it has a longer shelf life, and worst comes to worst, you can recentrifuge it and pack it again. I think we have more than enough weapon available should we need to use it, which I hope we never do.
Just a technical question. You have 12 years, say, roughly, for the warhead. What do you think next, Dr. Roy?
Again, I don't exactly know what to do. I don't believe the warhead has a 12-year lifespan. The half-life may drop it, and the impurities may increase, and the efficiency might be decreased a certain set amount. But once again, you could probably run it through the machinery and refine it again and come out with a smaller quantity. And so we'll only have, 5,000 nuclear weapons.
Interesting. I'm not good in it as much as in the other things. Yes, it is definitely 10 to 12 years is a typical lifespan for it. Interaction.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't sound right, though. I mean, they have the START program. Keep the things you go on defense. You know, they all these different agreements with different countries. In there. Both countries stopped making these things, as far as I know, but it's in the next 80s.
Hey guys, Google is your friend. The National Nuclear